Well, good evening, everybody. Good to see you. If you didn't get notes, they're over there on the little stand there as you come in the door. We're going to be in John chapter 10. I just noticed, by the way, it probably says this in your notes too. At the top, it says sermon title. There's a sermon title that's supposed to go in there. It didn't quite make it in. We are going to be in John chapter 10. As we were singing, I was just thinking about our time together, our time in the Word, and this opportunity to teach. And it is a real privilege to be able to unpack the Word together. Jesus asks us this question: what do you want me to do for you? How would you answer this question from Jesus? We talked about this last week. How would we respond to this question from Jesus? What do you want me to do for you? I believe that the conclusion that Jesus helps his disciples with is twofold. I think the first conclusion Jesus helps his disciples with is this reality. In particular, James and John, but also the other disciples, and by application us, the way you are answering the question is being informed by worldly values and practices more than you know. So this is Jesus' response to James and John and the other disciples. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. In other words, he was telling James and John, you have adopted this idea of being part of the kingdom from what you see going around you in the world. And your understanding of what it means to lead with me is being more informed by the world's values and the world system than you even understand. So that's the first conclusion that he helps them to come to. And the second conclusion, I think, is a little bit more inferred, but it seems pretty clear to me. This is the second conclusion. Jesus says, I want your response to my question, what do you want me to do for you, to be shaped more by me and my character than the world and theirs. He says this: whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even I, the Son of Man, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life for a ransom, as a ransom for many. I think Jesus could have said it this way to James and John: hey, brothers, I'm not sure after being with me and watching me minister how you came to the conclusion about being at my right and left hand. I'm not sure how you, watching my gentle serving, sacrificing for people, and yet you come to the conclusion we want to be on the right and the left hand. I'm not sure how you got there. Because I want your response to my question, what do you want me to do for you? I want your response to be shaped by me and my character rather than the world and theirs. So that's kind of a summary of last week. And maybe you with me are going, well, that's a lot more clear this week than it was last week. I felt like I didn't do a good job last week. I was burdened by that. I know I can tend to overthink things a little bit, and sometimes that convolutes the way I try to lead us in thinking about a passage. But I also know this is true. I think as Christians in today's culture, we also tend to underthink biblical principles and biblical truths as well. We breeze over passages like this question to James and John and to blind Bartimaeus. We breeze over them, and therefore our repentance and change is just about as shallow as our meditation on a particular passage. And I think sometimes in my efforts to think through a passage for my own life as well as on our behalf, I can get a little bit probably too intellectual, which is really funny. If you would go back to my high school friends and say, we really think, you know, this is a criticism Rob gets sometimes at church, he's a little bit too of an intellectual, they'd be like, Rob Bezosa. He only got a 2.2 so he could play basketball. But I think this is a great question for us. See, if we're going to remove any roadblocks between us and participating with Jesus in kingdom building, then we've got to be honest with ourselves about how we answer this question. What do you want me to do for you? So I think this application, so these two conclusions that Jesus helps his disciples with, I think they're really applicable for us today. And this is going to lead into our John chapter 10 passage, because the Mark passage we worked through last week and John 10 are really, really link well together. So here's this application, I think, for us today, that the way we want to consider that the way we would answer Jesus' question, if it's posed to us, may be more informed by cultural values and cultural practices than we know or we would want to admit. I think many of us would answer Jesus' question, what do you want me to do for you, with something, some kind of a mixture of Jesus plus or the gospel plus. We want our ease and the gospel. We want financial security and the gospel. We want our politicians in place and the gospel. We want good marriages and good kids and the gospel. We want our cushy vacations and the gospel. We want health and the gospel. We want easy church experience and the gospel. And I think not addressing the reality of how we would respond to Jesus' question can actually undermine the Spirit's work in our lives to move us out to kingdom building. Does that make sense? Those things that lie under the surface that we long for, that compete with the gospel in our lives, if we don't acknowledge them, then they will as the Spirit longs to work to move us more towards kingdom work, then those things will regularly come in and undermine the Spirit's work in our lives. So a casual glance at the passage last week, we might answer Jesus' question, well, I don't necessarily want to rule over God's kingdom, you know, like James and John. But in reality, while we may not lobby for right and left-hand positions with Jesus, we sure don't mind sitting on the throne of our own much smaller kingdom. I think we need to acknowledge that there's two false narratives or two ditches for us to avoid. This first ditch is the powerful, the loud, the outspoken, this relative truth narrative that is being peddled in our culture right now. All truth is relative. It's relative to any person who has one. And that's why we're bending in so many directions right now. Whoever has a truth, you have to bend to it. And we're all over the place. And this is, again, it's powerful. It's powerful than more powerful than we've ever seen. Although I do think, I was thinking about this meditating this week. You know why I think, have you ever thought about this when Jesus is before Pilate? Like, why didn't he just say he was God? Why didn't he just offer up an explanation? Think about the people now that get thrown into the limelight who try to offer an explanation about why they did what they did. It doesn't matter. True? I think our culture mimics the Roman culture, this powerful relative truth narrative. And I think that's definitely a very loud, pronounced, overwhelming reality in our lives right now. But for the sake of that one, we can't miss this other ditch, which is this more subtle, insidious, internal version of relative truth that undermines us from within. It's not just what we're being bombarded with from outside. It's this subtle ways that we negotiate the gospel that come from the inside as well. The Bible would call it our flesh. I don't do this very often nowadays. I was scrolling through Facebook. I just wanted to see what's happening, what people are talking about, what's on the forefronts of people's mind. And I spent about 20 minutes just going down my feed. And I literally got to the end and I was almost in tears. So discouraged and overwhelmed with these polarized positions. And I'm talking, most of the people that would be on my feed are believers that I know. Christians are being pulled into polarizing issues that, friends, ultimately, they really don't matter. But more importantly, they are also distracting us and keeping us from working together for the sake of the gospel. Now, how is that happening? And I think it would be wrong, brothers and sisters, for us to assume that that's all happening out there. We get pulled in to these polarizing arguments and these discussions. Why? For the very same reason, for the very same way that we would respond in if we're able to do it clearly in ways that we saw that the way we would respond to Jesus' question, what is it you want me to do for you? What we're motivated by, the things that we long for, that we would say, yes, Jesus, this is what I want you to do for us. That's what's pulling us into these polarized conversations that's distracting us from taking the gospel to a world that desperately needs it. So, that's a first application from last week. Jesus would say to us, careful, my little ones, that's us, because you may be more influenced by the world than you would like to see or admit. And we ought to be able to go, that's true, Lord. So then what? Well, then what, Rob? What do? We pray. And the second application is, he wants our response to his question to be shaped by his values and his perspective and who he is and how he has led us. It's him, it's Jesus we follow, and Jesus alone. True? And he came to serve and the sacrifice. So if I were to venture a guess based on our passage from last week and as we head into the passage for this week, how does Jesus what would the appropriate response? Jesus, this is what I've been asking myself. How would you want me to respond to this question to me, to us? What would you like me to do for you? I think this is the answer he wants us to give. Jesus, make me like you. Make me, fit me to be a servant. Jesus says to Rob, what would you like me to do for you? The response should be, ought to be, because it's good for me, not because it's an ought to or should, but because this is what he's longing for us. Make me a slave to all men for the sake of your kingdom. That's the response. And I will tell you, that sounds really good in this room with this group of people. But I thought about the reality in this culture of becoming a slave, a bondservant to the people in this culture, and it scares me. Does it scare you? To say to Jesus, you know how I would answer your question? Make me a servant. I'm telling you, it's going to cost us. So some of those things that I listed, we want the gospel plus. It will cost. But it's so worth it, right? Jesus wants to invert our lives. He's going to invert our reality. That is the gospel. I will radically turn your world upside down. James and John, you're asking for leadership. You're thinking about worldly values. But when you enter the kingdom, the things that are valued, the things that my Father says that will be exalted, is service and sacrifice. True? Why will Jesus be exalted? Because he is the greatest, the paramount, the example of complete and utter service and sacrifice. And as a result, he will be given the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, the servant, the sacrificer, every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And that, friends, that's who we follow. We follow him. Vine and branch, Jesus says to us, what do you want me to do for you? And we say, make us servants and cause us to sacrifice for the kingdom. It scares me. It takes faith for me to even say that to you. But I know because you're God and you tell me that's best for me. I believe in faith that that's the way I want to pray, even though it scares me. That's my prayer. That's our prayer. So we're going to take a look at John chapter 10. This passage, the first 18 verses, is primarily about Jesus. It's titled, The Good Shepherd. And we're going to jump in and see what Jesus says about himself being the Good Shepherd. But this evening, I want to take a little bit of a different look at it and consider, as we look at the passage, how Jesus has shepherded us as a model for how we serve and sacrifice for the sake of others. Does that make sense? If we're following Jesus, he's the ultimate. He steps on the scene in John chapter 10 and says, I am the good shepherd, and he's the way we follow. He's the one we follow. Then this passage is a great outline for how we can engage and sell and serve others by the example of Christ. So I'm going to pray. Then we're going to read these verses. Then I'm going to unpack the passage a little bit. And then we're going to take a look at some applications. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the way you point us to Christ in it. and in this opportunity to learn and to grow tonight from your word, John chapter 10. We need you. Lord, we don't want to just walk away knowing more about your word. We want your word to do something to us tonight. And we need your spirit to do that. Thank you for your promised work. You're committed to this in us. We want to be joyful participants. That we would see the kingdom is great and glorious, and that this is more than a worthwhile pursuit for us. And we need you. We've got so many things to adjust for us to see it that way. And so help us, even as we unpack these passages and think about the goodness of Christ Jesus, our shepherd, and how we can be like him. Thank you for this particular passage, and now may it run deep into our hearts through the power of the Spirit and our participation with him. Amen. Okay, John chapter 10. Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. When he has brought out all of his own, he goes out before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers." This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus again said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep, and I have other sheep that are not of this fold, I must bring them in also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I might take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father." So we're going to work through this passage. I'm just going to chunk off a couple passages at a time, one, two. I'm just going to briefly run through them. Here's your job. In your notes, you'll have a little section that's open. And as we're going through these passages, I'm asking you to listen for ways that Jesus engages as the Good Shepherd, how he treats and cares for the people that he is shepherding. And as those thoughts come to your mind, I'd like you to write them in that blank spot. So that's your role. That's your job. So a little context. Jesus is developing this good shepherd analogy, and he's going to do that in a couple of different ways as he moves through this parable. It connects with the previous chapter in John chapter 9 because Jesus actually contrasts himself against the Pharisees. So if you're not familiar, maybe later you can flip over to John chapter 9. The Pharisees, while they were spiritually blind, were claiming they had sight. And they were actually false shepherds. But as the true shepherd, Jesus comes to seek and to heal and to serve and to sacrifice. And his sheep hear and respond to his voice. So John chapter 9 is really a story about false shepherds who are all about themselves and lording it over people for their own benefit. By the way, this is the same reason that when James and John said, we want to be in leadership, Jesus says, you're thinking about it wrong. John chapter 9, that's what the Pharisees wanted. They wanted to lord it over, rule over people. That should not be so among you. So that's John chapter 9. And now John chapter 10, Jesus presents himself as the true shepherd. And he comes to seek and to heal and to serve and to sacrifice. And again, there's this philosophical and theological link between this passage and Mark's gospel that we talked about last week. What Jesus tells James and John is that selfishness and self-promotion have no place in true shepherding God's people. And again, we're going to look at this passage and see how Jesus describes himself and then look at the applications about how we can be like him in our shepherding, our love, our care of other people. So in verses 1 and 2, this actually Jesus describes a morning shepherding scene. So the evening before, a shepherd enters through a gate and into a walled enclosure, which could typically be about as big as this room. So how this would work in the Middle East is there would be one door, like this open door over here, and several shepherds would bring their herds into one big pen like this one. And all the sheep would mingle together in this for safekeeping. The gatekeeper knew who owned sheep and who didn't own sheep. So only the shepherds were allowed to come in to collect their sheep and then to lead them out. So when Jesus starts his story, he's describing a morning shepherding scene where a shepherd enters through the gate into the walled enclosure. The doorkeeper, the gatekeeper, recognizes him and says, "You're the owner. You have a right to enter the sheep pen because you're the rightful one." And so the watchman recognizes the shepherd, verses 3 and 4, and he says, "You can come in and gather up your sheep." So Jesus says the shepherd comes into the sheep pen, and he starts calling his sheep by name. They hear his voice and they start following him out the gate. Now, I got to tell you, many of you know Luke has a little flock of five sheep. And this has been like this fantastic learning experience for me. And he's got this, him and I worked on finding the Greek word for follow me, which is the word Jesus would have spoken in many parts of the New Testament. The Greek term would have been akalatheo, means follow me. So Luke actually uses this phrase akalatheo. So he goes out to his sheep pen when he wants to lead them into safety of the barn of night, so they're out of the danger of the coyotes. He goes out into his pasture and he starts calling them, "Akalatheo, Akalatheo," and they look up, and here comes all his little sheep following Luke, and here they come, and they know, "Oh, he's got some food for me," and he takes them right into the safety of the barn. It's really cool. Luke's sheep know Luke's voice, and they follow him. In the Middle East, shepherds knew their sheep well, and they gave them each a name. And as the sheep hear the sound of their owner's familiar voice, they go with him. So the shepherd, the scene that Jesus is describing, the shepherd comes into the gate. He starts calling his sheep, "Akolatheo, Akolatheo, follow me, follow me." This is us, friends. We perk up and we follow our shepherd. Then he takes them out of the gate. And leads them into the pasture. Verses 5 and 6. If a stranger enters the pen, the sheep will run away from him because his voice is not the voice that's familiar. You know, one of the things that I've also learned by watching Luke and his sheep is this. Sheep are not dumb. All of my life I've heard sheep are dumb, sheep are stupid. Here's where that must come from. Pastors who have never even seen a sheep before heard somebody say that truth one time, and they're just retelling it. And I said, Luke, here's one of my observations in watching you and your sheep. Sheep are not stupid. He said, no, Dad, actually they're listed in the top five of the smartest animals on the planet. But here's my other observation. Sheep are not dumb, but they are very fearful. And here's my observation from counseling. When you combine intelligence and fear, sometimes stupid things happen. And I think what happens with sheep is they're not dumb. They're actually very intelligent, but they're very fearful. And when you combine intelligence and fear, sometimes you get stupidity. Luke informed me that studies have proven that sheep can remember over 50 human faces that they haven't seen in over a 2-year period. It's pretty amazing. I don't know how they do that, you know, how they figure that out. Like if somebody walks in a room after 2 years, they watch the sheep, and the sheep's like, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. I mean, I don't know how they figure that out, but it's proven. Somebody's figured that out. But here's what we also know from the passage. And from the reality of what we know about shepherding, sheep can differentiate between voices. They know when their shepherd is calling them, and they know when somebody who's trying to mimic, a stranger is trying to mimic that voice, and they won't follow that voice. And here's what we also know from this passage and from animal science, that sheep's relational exposure or their relational connection to the shepherd helps them to hear and discern their shepherd's voice over a stranger's voice. And what Jesus says in this passage is, my sheep know my voice. They can hear other voices. And they'll go, that's not my shepherd. They'll hear another voice, one that's even trying to mimic, and they'll go, that's not my shepherd. Jesus says, if a stranger comes in and he's uttering strange words, my sheep won't follow. Why? Because my sheep know my voice. Verses 7 through 9, Jesus develops this shepherd-sheep figure of speech in another way. After a shepherd's flock has been separated from the other sheep, in other words, after they go outside of the gate, he takes them out to a pasture, and near the pasture is an enclosure for the sheep. Now, this would be similar on Luke's sheep area. It's probably about this big. He's got one big gate. And if he came into that pasture where there was green, he's also got the barn. He could stand in the gate and the sheep can go into the pasture and eat. But if they get nervous, they'll run into the barn. And what Jesus develops in verses 7 through 9 is this idea of the shepherd taking these sheep out to pasture, and he's standing in the gate, but they have opportunity to graze. But there's also, in Jesus' time, there would have been a roundish area with an opening in it. And if the sheep were afraid, they could run into there, or they could come out and they could graze. And if they got nervous, they could go back in there. Or if they felt comfortable, they could come back out and eat. And Jesus is standing in the main gate of this whole thing, and he's watching this whole thing take place. The spiritual meaning that Jesus is trying to help us with is this, that Jesus is the one who provides and gives security. You can go here and eat, or there's this pen where you can go and feel safe, and I'm watching over both of those things happen. I'm the gate. In other words, Jesus offers and provides both protection or security and provision, nurture. Now a thief, verse 10, would be different. Thief is a false shepherd, and they really care only about feeding themselves, not about making the flock better or the individual sheep. The thief takes advantage of the sheep, and he consumes or kills the sheep for his own benefit. That's what a false shepherd does. Nowhere in God's economy is there a place for selfishly ruling or lording over others. Again, this should bring up our thoughts and responses to James and John and the other disciples, which is also why Peter would say in 2 Peter that the shepherds of God's flock, us under shepherds, aren't to lord it over either. Because those who lead the flock, that would be the shepherding team here at Vine and Branch, we are not to lord it over either. Why? Because Jesus didn't. There's no place in God's economy for a selfish ruling or lording over others. Christ has come to benefit the sheep, to serve and to sacrifice. He gives his life. And this life is not constricted, but it's overflowing. The thief takes life. Christ gives life to the full. Verse 11. Jesus then develops the sheep shepherd figure in a third way. When evening settles over the land of Palestine, danger lurks. So in Bible times, lions and wolves and jackals and panthers and leopards and hyenas and bears were common in the countryside. We even know David had tangles with several different animals as he was a shepherd. In other words, the life of a shepherd could be dangerous. A shepherd puts himself in harm's way to care for his sheep. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this whole coronavirus thing. Is this new? Lord, in the Bible, you know what would have been similar to? Leprosy. Jesus is saying that a shepherd puts himself in harm's way to care for others. Jesus is not a careless shepherd, but he's not a fearful shepherd either. He comes to give his life for their benefit. Again, Jesus came, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And that is why he's the great shepherd, Hebrews chapter 13, or our chief shepherd, 1 Peter 5. And so in verses 12 through 13, in contrast with the good shepherd who owns and cares for and protects and dies for his sheep, There's one who works for wages. He's the hired hand, and he actually doesn't own the sheep. He's just supposed to care for them. But he's interested, again, only in his own interests and being served himself and self-preservation. And so when danger comes, when fear lurks, he scatters and he leaves the sheep to danger. And again, I'm asking you, remembering, how does Jesus care? How do we care? And so in verses 14 through 15, in contrast with this hired workman, the good shepherd has intimacy with and a personal interest with his sheep. We see it in verse 3 and again in verse 27. Jesus says, I know my sheep. This stresses ownership and watchful oversight. And then he says, and my sheep know me. And this stresses a reciprocal knowledge and an intimacy with the shepherd. And then in verse 16, Jesus says that there's other sheep that are not of this flock. This refers to the Gentiles, by the way. This is me and you, who would believe as a result of Jesus' death and resurrection, that he brings us in also to the fold. They too, again, that's us, they will listen to my voice. And even today, friends, Jesus continues to save people as he calls their name and we respond. And the way he does that, verses 17 and 18, he predicts his death four times, saying he would voluntarily lay down his life. Verse 11, 14, 17, and 18. He would voluntarily. Nobody has forced him to do it. And because of that, the Father has a special love for Jesus because of his sacrificial obedience to the will of God. Jesus was sovereignly, he had authority over his own destiny. His death was wholly voluntary. He said, no one takes it from me. He gave it up for us. The Son of Man comes not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So let's talk about that for a minute. Hopefully you've jotted some things down. Let's think about this. What are some applications for us as we consider Jesus' life? He's our good shepherd. We want to press in and serve and sacrifice for others just like Jesus. What are some applications we could pull out of Jesus' life and apply to our own? Ways we engage people, ways we love and care for those around us. Any thoughts? We serve. Okay, Luke said service. What else? We make time. Yep. What's that? Develop relationships. Yeah. Anything else? Other thoughts? To love enemies. It's good. What's that? To provide defense for those who are weaker. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Tim said to He said a key aspect is being able to hear the voice of the shepherd and continue to develop it so that that becomes a regular part of our following, is hearing the shepherd's voice and responding. It's good. Any other thoughts, Bob? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that he went to the sheep, he went in, and then it says he leads them out. He initiates. Yeah. He developed trust. Yeah. Good. Anything? Yeah. Yes. Jason said personally invested, that he's got investment skin in the game. Jason said it's not just a hired hand, but there's a deep investment. It's good. Yes. Yeah. John said there's a lot of voices out there, a lot of varied voices out there, and we can help people discern what voice is the right one and which is true. It's really good. There's a lot in this passage. When the boys and I went on our trip to Minnesota, one of my things was I was just meditating on this passage just to see how did Jesus shepherd and are there applications for us? And I think I came up with 12 or 13 different things. And so you guys did a great job at covering. I'm going to be vague on purpose in this application because I think we need to really press into this passage together. And we've done a good preliminary job here, but I want to encourage you to press in deeper. What are ways that we can be shepherding, leading, caring for people like Christ did? This is how we serve and sacrifice. True? This is a great start for us. So I'm just going to give us four to think about, and we've covered some of these, but let's continue to go deeper on these. And I think the first one is we must tune ourselves to hear the voice of our shepherd, Jesus. And, you know, different people have said that. Not the voice of culture. Not the voice of our own, even our kingdom question, if you understand what I'm saying, this way we would answer Jesus' question. But to follow Jesus' voice, to follow Jesus' voice with his posture as a servant and as a slave to all. Loved ones, if we're going to be effective in building the kingdom, then we have to tune ourselves in to recognize our shepherd's voice from the world's and even our own. This will keep us out of non-gospel, irrelevant arguments that distract us from helping people to hear the shepherd's voice. Look, I don't care, nor do I want people necessarily. I think you'll understand what I'm saying. I don't care if people follow a particular political leader. So that ought not to take up the majority of my energy and my conversations with people. I want them to hear the voice of Christ. Let's tune ourselves, and as John said, help as we learn to do that, that we will help others tune in to hear the voice of Jesus. There is, by the way, an ultimate truth. And the ultimate truth that's being peddled today is there is no ultimate truth. That's the ultimate truth that people want to say is the ultimate truth, which is you can't do that. right? There is no ultimate truth except the one I'm telling you. There is an ultimate truth. His name is Jesus. And we can tune our ears to hear him. The second thing is kind of like what Jason said is, but like Jesus, we can know people and invite them into relationship. Dan said this too. Verse 4 says, when he has brought out all his own, he goes before them and the sheep follow him. Bob said, we initiate. We care enough about people. You know, one of the simple ways for us to apply this passage is simply by learning somebody's name and speaking their name. John and I were talking a little bit about this passage this week, and he was talking to me briefly about the science behind belonging and what secular therapists are starting to understand about how important it is to be known by somebody and loved and to be part of a group. A simple application is sometimes just knowing people and calling them by name, even if they're in a different political party. I met for an impromptu coffee with a man who had changed his gender several months ago. Friends, before I start lobbing gospel grenades of truth in his life, I need to know his name. Because he bears the image of the same God that I bear his image. That's where his value comes from. You'll see a little thing in the acrostic on the bottom of your notes. And if you look down, the acrostic is the word forms. Facts, opinions, responses, motivations, and then shepherding or strategy. And I want to offer that as a really super practical tool for you to use in conversations with people. So, it kind of flows in process. Facts are facts. It's hot outside. Or there's bad things happening. Then it moves to opinions. There's bad things happening in our world today. Oh, what do you think about that? That's somebody's opinion. Oh, now that I know how you think about that, how have you responded to that? What are you doing about what you think? And then what motivates that kind of response? What motivates you to respond that way? And then this last one, the S, is shepherding or strategy, which is just, where is this person in relationship to Jesus, and how can I help them take one or two steps closer to Jesus? This forms that little acrostic for me has been super helpful. You ever been in a conversation with somebody and you're just kind of going round and round and you're like, how do I move this to a deeper level? One of the things I do in my mind is I'll ask myself, where am I in the conversation? And I'll be like, oh, we've just been talking about opinions for 10 minutes. So why don't I ask him a question that's going to move more towards his response and how he's been responding about his opinion? And then what actually motivates that response? And this little acrostic has helped me to move deeper in conversations. Now I do it almost intuitively, but it's really just practically helping me and then getting to the end of the conversation and going, is there a way I can help this person take one step closer to Jesus as a result of our conversation? Or maybe just store it up. Maybe that's not what I need to do right now, but I can store it up for the next conversation. What does this person need in their relationship to Christ that's revealed by this conversation that we just had? So I offer that to you as a very practical tool to do this. Like Jesus, we can know people and invite them into relationship. I think a third principle that we could pull out of here, again, of many, but like Jesus, we can put ourselves aside for the sake of others. I think sometimes we need to recognize when we want our gospel plus or our Jesus plus. And sometimes those are really good things and we ought to be able to enjoy those. But there are other times when we realize that there's this thing I want to do and yet there's this gospel opportunity. Either can I blend them together or can I just get rid of this one in order to help somebody move towards the kingdom? That we're called to be servants who are making sacrifices. And like our shepherd Jesus, we can put ourselves aside for the sake of others. And it will be worth it. And then the last thing is, like Jesus, we can provide places of security and rest. I think one of the things we see in the passage is Jesus providing these places of people to come in and find rest. And you guys know this, but just to be clear, I'm not talking about moral neutrality. I'm not talking about people just being able to share kind of whatever with, you know, no consequence. But they don't necessarily need the consequence right now, right? But I am talking about places where people can express their questions and their doubts and their struggles, where we bear burdens of people as opposed to talk to people under burdens. Next week, we're going to start working on this process of what does it look like to step into people's tension and to understand their difficulty before we go right to loading them up with a bunch of truth. How do we, like Jesus, step into the lives of people in these gospel opportunities and come alongside them and provide places of security and rest where they can begin to see the love of Christ, the love of their ultimate good shepherd for them. These places where we allow people to have these conversations about things, and yet at the same time, we gently hold out truth as absolute, because ultimately, absolute truth doesn't belong to us. It belongs to Christ. And it's Him we're pointing ourselves to. So I offer those as some applications, but again, I think we just need to continue to press in together. But those are some. In my study, I read a great quote. It's from a missionary in the early 1800s named Henry Martin, and he was a missionary to India and Persia, again in the early 1800s. And he said this, and I've been thinking a lot about it. He says, "You are immortal until God's purpose for you is complete." Isn't that good? We're immortal or invincible. One pastor modernized it and says, "You're bulletproof until God's purpose for you is complete." Friends, we have the voice of our shepherd. We have the relationship of a shepherd who's called us by our names and invites us into relationship. We have a shepherd who has put himself aside for our sake. And we have a shepherd who provides places of grace and security and rest for us as we, because we've received a lot of this, as we have grown and changed. True? Because we didn't get this overnight, but He's provided these places of security and rest, and we can move out like Him, because here's the truth: He knows our days are numbered, and we are bulletproof. We are immortal until He says we're done. And we can move out in the faith and the love and the security of Christ and follow our shepherd Jesus. So Lord, help us to do that in practical ways. again, run this truth and press these things on us as we press in to your word and to the world around us together for the sake of your kingdom. Amen.